Okay, so what I'd like to talk about is basically what I've gotten done in the last year and a half. Isn't a whole lot. Outline for you quickly is basically bring where we left off last time. And then where we left off last time was actually on the plane, not on the sphere. So what we've done since then is move to the sphere. And what I want to talk about is basically testing these discrete finite difference operators on the sphere, comparing our geodesic shallow water model to the spectral model. I think in the process, opening up a can of worms that we haven't fully sorted out yet. Measuring conservation, which I think is the kind of real important aspect of this numerical scheme. And then comparing the vorticity divergence formulation to do a compatible momentum formulation. And then basically asking the question, does any of this matter? I mean, we invest an enormous amount of time developing these schemes and doing these test cases. And sooner or later, we have to ask ourselves, you know, is this important? If we put this into a full AGCM, what does it do? Of course, when we move into the full AGCM, we have difficulty seeing a whole lot, and I think that's one reason why we don't do a lot of analysis there. And then conclusions and kind of what I hope to do in the next year and a half. So where we left off last time? Last time I presented results on the perfect hexagonal grid. And even though this was the PDEs on the sphere, I was allowed to come back, so I appreciate that. We had formulated and tested this numerical scheme and shown that it had some very nice properties. These were mostly being able to manipulate the discrete equations in the same way that we manipulate the continuous equations, and basically being able to show that we have this set of vector identities that while we all know hold in the continuous equations, I would say in general do not hold in our discrete systems. And basically this first identity is critical for conserving total energy. The two terms on the right hand side are similar to two terms that come out in the energy derivation, and we need to be able to write them as a divergence to be able to conserve total energy. This is related to what Luca was saying previously about not generating any spurious vorticity. We don't want the curl of our gradient. We always want the curl of our gradient to be zero around any path. I think this is critical for particularly atmospheric and any geophysical fluid where rotation is the dominant motion. And then B and C are actually two kind of more obscure identities, but these identities are necessary to be able to take the curl and divergence of the momentum equation and produce the vorticity divergence equation. So I think I kind of outlined what these vector identities get us. They get us conservation of energy in space, so our spatial discretization is not creating or destroying energy. C and D combined with an averaging gets us conservation. Well, C and D gets us conservation of potential vorticity in the shallow water framework. I guess there should be an and here, and potential entropy. On the perfect hexagonal grid, all of our discretizations were second order accurate, and we had an interchangeable momentum and vorticity divergence formulation. In the continuous system, we can use the momentum formulation, we can use the vorticity divergence formulation. They are exactly the same. And this would be a nice property for discrete models as well. So work we've completed since last time. So we basically generalized the scheme to a spherical geodesic grid, and with the exception of the order of accuracy that I'm going to talk about later, all of the previous data quantities carry over. And there's two papers there, and I have reprints and PDFs if anyone is interested. So to kind of give you a framework, the grid staggering, what we have here is a system that is, as Luca was saying previously, our control volumes are the hexagons. we have a, this is a staggered grid system. We put a full velocity vector at every corner. All scalar fields, you know, mass, kinetic energy, vorticity, and divergence are going to live here in the center, basically inside the control volume. And velocity and basically gradients of scalar fields are going to live at the corner. And we choose this staggering for a couple reasons. One, we get this compatibility between the momentum and vorticity, momentum and the Vort-Div equations. Requires a minimum amount of averaging. In fact, there's only one averaging operator needed to integrate the fully nonlinear shallow water equations. And I'm going to talk about that, and that's the averaging of scalars from the centers to the corners. And also, this gives us, I think, of any second-order accurate approximation, the best geostrophic adjustment relation possible. So just to outline quickly, I'm not going to go through all the gory detail of the derivations, because if you're interested in that, it's in the paper. But I do want to give you a feel for how these operators work. And so this is the derived divergence operator. And basically what we do is we have an analytic definition of what we mean by the divergence, and we simply generalize that, where the integral around the boundary is this, because this is our control volume. We have normal vectors here along our boundary. We have a velocity that's defined here at the corners, and we get the divergence by summing over our corners and dividing by our area. So it has a very nice physical interpretation, as most finite volume schemes do. The gradient operator has an equally nice comparison to the analytic definition. So here's our definition. Again, so this is the integral around the volume, but since our vectors live at the corners, we're integrating around our triangles. So we are actually using both grids. We're using the hexagonal grid and we're using the dual triangular grid. The hexagonal grid is used for scalars and the dual grid, the triangles, are used for vectors. And then what we get is, so we do the same thing. We integrate, we have our normal vectors. We get a gradient that lives at the center. And what comes out is that the divergence operator is adjoint to the gradient operator. And that is critical for, well, it's necessary for conserving total energy. So that just kind of gives you a feel for our methods. Now, there is a compatibility between the vorticity divergence formulation and the momentum formulation with one important exception. And this has to do with computational modes or null spaces. Basically, the gradient operator that I showed before has no null spaces. Because what we're doing is we're taking three data points, and we're basically, what comes out of here is we're fitting a plane to them, and we can do that exactly. So there are no patterns that we can generate that the gradient won't see. The gradient operator has an empty null space, which is different from quadrilateral grids. So the gradient operator has no null space, but the divergence and kernel operators do have a null space. In fact, and I've shown a pattern on the right there that demonstrates one of those patterns. So if we apply the divergence or kernel operator to this grid scale pattern, you can see this kind of has a grid scale pattern to it, we get zero, which means that's a computational mode. We put that velocity field in, and we get a zero out. So these patterns are invisible to the Div curl operators. Now, we generate the Laplacian operator by taking the divergence of our gradient. So what comes out is the Laplacian operator has no computational modes. It has an empty null space, basically because our gradient has an empty null space. So if we integrate the momentum equations, what happens is nonlinear terms can project energy into this grid scale pattern, but there's no dynamical feedback. There's no way for that energy to get out of the system. So this actually leads us to using the vorticity divergence equations more, because what we can do is eliminate this grid scale mode through this step here. We compute our divergence, we compute our vorticity, we invert two elliptic equations for chi, our velocity potential, and our stream function, And then we recompute our wind by taking the gradient of these potentials. This is basically a Hamel decomposition. And what happens is that in this process right here, when we take the divergence and the curl, you can see here, we would get zero. So this would be zero, this would be zero, and we invert, we get zero. So this is basically the perfect filter for this computational mode in the divergence operator. So testing the spatial operators. So I'm going to just look at the spatial discretization, then we're going to look at the shallow water test cases. So what we're testing here is the gradient and the divergence. I'm taking the divergence of the gradient, our Laplacian operator, for a test function. So we have our convergence right here of minus 2, L1, L2. Norms are coming down something near minus 2. And this is pretty well known that the infinity norm does not converge on the straight, what we call the unmodified spherical geodesic grid. But if we tweak it or somehow optimize the grid, we can get the infinity norm to converge as well. But so our operator here is near second order accuracy. There is one interpolation, and this interpolation, we don't pick this. This comes out of the energy conservation derivation. And it tells us that if we want to interpolate a scalar K from the centers to the corners, it basically has to be an area-weighted average. And this area-weighting average is second-order accurate on an equilateral grid, but it's only first-order accurate on a spherical geodesic grid, an unoptimized spherical geodesic grid. And I show that here. Here's a convergence rate of minus 1. We're coming down at about minus 1. And our infinity norms are coming down as well. And in this case, the averaging operator between the tweaked and untweaked grid are the same. So the important take-home point at this juncture is that our operators are all converging. Somewhere between first order and second order accurate, all of our operators are converging. So now we're going to move to the test case, shallow water test case, which has been talked about quite a bit. We're going to use the vorticity divergence formulation. I'm going to actually compare it to the momentum formulation in a bit. We're comparing to the spectral model. We actually obtained the spectral model from NCAR, from Dave Williamson and Jim Hagen colleagues. Tinkered with it for a while and ran it at T213, which is the reference solution that's on the web was run at T13 but truncated to T106. It was a very circular effort on our part, but we came to the conclusion that we needed a higher resolution. And what we're going to look at here is the norms compared to the spectral model. So we're going to run our model, we're going to take the spectral model as truth, and we're going to look at the L2, L1, L infinity norms. Then we're going to look at conservation of energy and potential entropy. So we do this, and things look good at the beginning. Here's the L2 norm. Here's day, 15 days. Coarse resolution, finer, 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 finer. So we start at coarse, we run it finer, norms go down. We run it finer, norms go down. Run it finer, not so much. In fact, we get to a point when we're not converging at all. So if I plot this differently, now what I'm going to do is just go to day 15 and plot the L2 norm for the different resolutions. So here we have the L2 norm again going this way, but now we're going number of grid points this way. So out here we're at about 600 grid points, and out here we're at about 160,000 grid points. And I went through all the literature I could find that it's done test case 5 and has compared it to the spectral model, so that we're all kind of on the same, we're on the same page. So there's two data points from Hikas and Randall in 95. There's one data point from Stoon and Peltier, and then there's a convergence test that was done by Tomita et al. And then there's our work here. Basically, these are the data points I showed on the previous plot. And we see convergence, and then we see a flattening. And I was ready to just say it was the spectral model, it was truth. You know, basically we don't have real truth. We need to make our truth better. But the Tomita et al. Paper shows that, well, they did it. And I'm perplexed, and I started asking around, and maybe this is a bit of a trade secret that I wasn't aware of, that a lot of people have compared to shallow water test case 5 and found exactly the same result. So this needs to be rectified, because this is not a predictability or a nonlinear issue. This curve says that one instance is enough to produce, I think, to prove that this is not. We can't just say truth is bad. We can't just say the system is not predictable at day 15. Something's going on here, and there are some differences. I mean, so what we're trying to do is figure out how Tomita et al. Did this. And there's a whole list of things that could be going on here. It could be the nonlinearity. There is, in fact, some lower bound that we should expect due to nonlinearity. What about truth, the spectrum model? That was, you know, always blame the other guy. That was my first thought. And then we have the very technical and detailed aspects of how we compute the error. And there's a whole list of them. So when I look at the Tomita et al. Work, basically, you know, there are some differences, some real differences. You know, they did use an optimized grid. We're using the unoptimized grid. Yet even on our unoptimized grid, all of our operators are converging. We did actually each run our own spectral model. So maybe there's some difference in our spectral models. They are using a fourth order Runge-Kutta. We're using Leapfrog. Do I think that's the difference? No, I don't, but that is a difference. And then there are differences in the numerical scheme. We're on a ZZM grid, on an A grid, and then the analysis technique. But then there is another bit of data that hasn't really gotten clarified as well, is that Stuhn and Peltier in 99 note this lack of convergence above 10.242, which is the same resolution I'm using, for shallow water test case 3, which has an analytic solution. So this is the can of worms that I think I'm opening up, that I actually have to get to the bottom of one way or another. So anyone has any ideas? I'm very open. Maybe that we can discuss that at the end of the talk. Yes? Yes? The right-hand side. Right. I think that comes into the error, yes, under the topic of error analysis, how we're computing. Are we just sampling at a center? Are we integrating the solution over the control volume? Yeah. Okay. Right. Right. Okay. Go ahead. I guess.
Okay, Kevin, by the way, I just speculated really speculation that this is meant to come into impact and we have spectral blocking in one or another, depending on your reducing spectral model or not, and so on.
Okay, so that falls under, yeah, truth, yeah, okay.
And you need to look at the spectral decision.
Right. It's explicit using Adams-Bash for third order, which is the same time stepping scheme we're using.
I have tried learning some double quadratic model, semi implicit and explicit, sometimes implicit model, and my semi implicit model has been like 7 and 10 to 10 to 2. I thought it's because I'm averaging my latitude where it's
Right. Right. Okay. We've actually tested the time step, and we don't think in our model it's time truncation, because we're just using an explicit scheme. But it's something that we'll look at more. I think. What? Yeah. T T6, I mean, if you're looking at the Gaussian grid, something like T60. It's way low compared to our reference solution. Right. Right, but if you read closely in the Tomita et al. Paper, that they say specifically that they used T216 in the error calculation. So we are if that's right, if the paper's actually right. So. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. So. I don't think we're going to resolve this here. Let me press through real quick, 5 or 10 minutes. Something that actually turned out quite a bit better, which is assessing total energy conservation. Same test case, same model, actually same exact runs that we were just looking at, but now we're looking at something else. So this is the log of the change in total energy. So if you can all tilt your head, this is a total energy time T minus T at zero, normalized by T at zero, where we've subtracted out the massive amount of energy that's basically unavailable potential energy. So we're not biasing to make our results look better. And this is, I think, pretty typical of what the test case asked us to do. Time is going this way. This is just four different resolutions. The dark blue here is 10242, and then I got three other data points from the literature. The Heikes et al. 95. These are all 10242, so I'm comparing basically this dark blue line should be compared to those blue dots. The student and policy 99 and the Tomita et al. 2001. So at day 15, the differences between the results that we're getting and what I've been able to find in the literature is, I guess, somewhere about 3 orders of magnitude better in total energy conservation. And so this is important. Actually, this is for us. This is mostly a bug checker, because we've shown this derivation on a piece of paper. So now we're running the numerical model just to show it, just to prove to ourselves that we're actually doing it. Of the four different models that are up here, this is the only one that can formally show that energy conservation on a piece of paper, which is what we actually believe conservation is. Potential entropy, same thing, same layout, four different models with increasing resolution going this way. The blue here is compared to those three other, and we're looking at something like 1 to 2 orders of magnitude better. So now quickly, so what if we run the momentum formulation? Previously, we've been looking at the vorticity divergence formulation. This is the momentum formulation in viscid, so there's no dissipation on the right-hand side. Shallow water test case 5, I think this is 10242. This is just a snapshot of day 10. Here's a picture, here's another picture with a box, here's a blow-up of that box, here's a box, here's a blow-up of that box. So this computational mode I was talking about, we can't actually see it here. We have the perfect filter, so we can always check and see how much noise is in the computational mode. And even in that field right there, I think it's like 2 or 3% of the total amount of kinetic energy is in this computational mode. And that energy can't get out, so it stays in there and will continue to grow. So if we actually take that momentum formulation that I just showed and add enough dissipation to it to simply keep I think I keep the amount of kinetic energy in the computational mode less than 0.1% of the total amount of kinetic energy. So that's the only reason we have the dissipation here is to kind of keep that computational mode under control. Then what we have here, there's two bits of information on this plot. Everything is in air, and this is time going this way that I didn't. The axis is too low. And there's two lines here. This is the airfield in our. This is the height field air compared to the spectral model. Blue is the vorticity divergence form, and red is the momentum equation. So they lie practically right on top of each other. So as far as accuracy goes, the two formulations are identical. We can see that the dissipation has moved our total energy conservation from somewhere down into the, you know, from the minus 5 range up to the minus 3 range. So we lose our quantitative energy conservation by adding that dissipation operator. So since we try not to really be too applied here, I didn't want to bring, you know, real-world AGCM simulations. These are idealized simulations, stuff that I'm doing for other work. And so what we have here, so we took this scheme, put it into a full physics atmospheric general circulation model. And what we have here is an aquaplanet with a single land mass that might look something like South America. And we have an idealized mountain here, and we have a coastal anomaly. So it's an idealized setup that has some bearing to the real world. And we do two simulations. We have a control, which is our old numerical scheme, and then we have an experiment, which is our new dynamics. Everything else in the entire AGCM is the same. The physics are the same. The boundary initial conditions are the same. It's as close to a clean experiment as I think we can get. And as we all know, and that kind of right below the heading there, assessing impact is easy. Following the physical linkages from perturbation to impact is not. And all I'm going to be doing here is assessing impact. I'm just going to show you two quick pictures because they make the point. This is the sea level pressure and PBL wind. I've kind of zoomed in here. So here's our land mass, and we have here's our mountain would be here. We have a coastal anomaly here, so we get what we expect, a subtropical high. And we can see that there are quantitative differences here, particularly over the land mass, particularly in the strength of what we would think of in this simulation as the monsoon low. The flow over the continent is different. If we look at precipitation, the precipitation is quantitatively different. This is not, to the best of my knowledge, sampling error. I mean, now we are in a fully nonlinear system. We have to worry about sampling. This is not sampling. These are different. I'm not saying which is better. Neither of them are right. We don't know what right is. And since we don't know what truth is, we don't know which one is better. But we do know that we have one simulation that has the same formal accuracy but doesn't conserve, you know, total energy and potential entropy, and we have another one that's the same order of accuracy that does, and they lead to different simulations. This is an average, I think, over like a month. So let me come to conclusions. We need to do more work here, but it seems, at least at this point, pretty clear to me that conserving these properties leads to significant changes in AGCM. I'm not saying that these changes are making the simulation better. I don't know that. But what I do know and what I believe, and I think what we all have to believe if we're in the business of numerical modeling, is that mimicking the continuous equations will lead to more accurate simulations. And the continuous equations conserve these things, so we should be doing that as well. And what kind of gets in the way is all the other parameterizations. It is possible to put in a better parameterization and get worse results if we compare it to the real world. And if you're in the business of numerical weather prediction, then that's bad, and you go a different direction. So these improvements may or may not be immediate, but I think as long as we stay focused on what's important, and I think the important thing is mimicking the continuous equations, then eventually we will get a better simulation. Compared to other geodesic results, we're doing much better in conserving these things. I didn't make a big point of this, but of course resolutions were a factor of two or more better in formal accuracy than anything else that we've compared to, but that we're seeing this flattening, this, you know, can of worms, that at the higher resolution. And all of this is somewhat perplexing, given that our operators are all showing convergence. Oops, you don't want to see that again. So where to from here? It's pretty easy for us to optimize this grid to lead to a second order accurate interpolation operator, and we're in the process of doing that. And we're also in the process of kind of forming a collaboration with folks that do grid optimization for a living. I mean, there is a whole field in CFD that is due to taking a grid and constructing a new grid from it that has certain nice properties. And there's big packages of software out there. And so instead of reinventing the wheel yet again, our effort here is to kind of talk to the experts, tell them what we think is important about our grid, and see if we can actually get a robust piece of software that we can really tinker with and experiment with different grids pretty quickly. I think actually once we've smoothed the grid, I've been able to identify that, you know, you can force computational modes in a lot of ways, and one of the easiest way to force them is by having grid scale noise. And that grid scale noise can actually be in the grid, and that's what we have right now. And the majority of the computational modes, I think, are being forced by the fact that we don't have a smoothly varying grid. So we're going to smooth that, and then we're going to look at it using the momentum formulation in the context of ocean modeling. And I said I was going to talk about it, and I've actually done it, but there wasn't enough time. We can extend this discretization to rank two tensors that can be used for calculations of rates of strain, and we can actually make sure that the rank two tensor identities hold in the discrete system, so that we can ensure that, for instance, if you look at the Navier-Stokes equations, there is a connection between the dissipation on the right-hand side and the internal energy, and we can actually formally close that budget by making our rank two tensors. And all this stuff is available online. If you picked up the shallow water model before, you should update it. The multi-grid's in there. We fixed some small coding errors. Thank you.